Hello, everybody, and welcome to today's audio conference training on enhancing our work with men who use violence, offered by the Office on Violence Against Women in partnership with Praxis International. I hope you enjoyed our music. It got a little jazzier than normal, so I'm quite impressed. My name is Beth McNamara, and I'll be the host for your call. I hope you're all enjoying your summer and having a great time trying to relax a little bit. I wanted to let you know many people have let me know that they weren't able to join us for last week's call, and several people have let me know that they can't make it to this week's call and wanted to know how they could access it. So I just wanted to remind everyone that we're recording this call, and we're going to be placing the entire series on our website at praxisinternational.org on online streaming, which means that once it's posted on our website, you'll be able to access it anytime you want, and you can start and stop it and listen to it whenever you have some free time. So look for that. I hope no later than the first week of August is our hope that we'll have the entire series posted. And we'll also post any materials that are mentioned on the entire series, as well as all the materials that supported these calls. We'll post them in binders next to the recordings so that you can access both of those anytime you need to. Wanted to also let you know that a few hours ago I emailed everyone out four case studies that we're going to integrate into our training call today. So if you had a chance to read them already or peruse them or print them out, that's great. It's not mandatory. We just thought it might be a little bit helpful if you had a head start on looking them over. If you're next to your computer, you can do that now. It just should have come into your email just a couple of hours ago, so there should be a pretty recent email in your inbox. And as I mentioned, I had sent out additional materials. It wasn't a whole lot. It was our other facilitator, Scott Hampton, who has graciously agreed to join us for today's training call. I posted his bio on the confirmation for today's call, so you can scroll that too at your leisure and take a look at that. Also wanted to let everyone know that OVW supports these calls, and the notion that training and support from a whole variety of organizations is very important. They purposely and intently are interested in having you get as much support as possible. So while Praxis International is one of those technical assistance providers for this grant program, we try very hard to stay in line with OVW's viewpoints and how this initiative is moving forward, and with all of the other TA providers as well. But we're not speaking on behalf of OVW during these calls, so I just wanted to clarify that what you hear on these calls is a viewpoint of Praxis and or our presenters and not OVW. So if you hear something that you're wondering if that's a mandatory statement or how you should proceed for all calls as dictated by OVW, it's just not true. We're just trying to help you support critical thinking and moving through and doing a better job, but we're not saying this is the way it is. All right, so we are into our second session of this three-part series. The entire three-part series is called Enhancing Our Work with Men. And today's topic, which is the second part of this series, is dealing with problematic behavior. And like I mentioned before, we have Scott Hampton on the call with us today. And Dr. Hampton, he has been working with men who use violence for quite a number of years, and he's also been engaged with the supervised visitation field for quite a number of years. I've had the privilege of working with him for a long time and appreciate every opportunity I have to talk with him and brainstorm and think through, so I know you're going to enjoy today's call. We are going to try very hard, Scott and I, to take breaks for questions, but we also don't want you to feel like you have to wait for a formal official break to ask a question. So if something comes up in your mind, you want to engage in a conversation, you want to chime in about something, please feel free to press number one. Stephanie, our operator, is on the line the entire call with us, which means that she can put you in a question queue. She can instant message me to let me know that there is a question, and I can purposely take a break any time and interrupt kind of whenever we take a chance and put those in. You also have the option of emailing me anytime during the call, and I can put those comments or questions into our call as well. So feel free to email me at Beth, B-E-T-H, at praxisinternational.org, and I'll pop those questions in. So those are the best ways that we can think about in order for you to engage in the conversation and join in and get all your questions answered and asked and your comments out there without being able to just speak freely. We have several hundred, you know, lines that we can possibly have open on these calls, and if you could just imagine all the background noise of that. So we keep everyone's line muted just for the ease of people listening and to have a clear recording at the end of this call. But we don't want you to stop from being a part of it, so please do be a part of it. So without further ado, all of that housekeeping stuff is over, and I'm going to turn it over to Scott, and we're going to get started. So thanks, Scott.
Thanks, Beth. Thanks for the intro, and I'm really excited about actually every time having a chance to talk about this stuff and do projects with Praxis and with Safe Havens grantees has been really wonderful for me. As Beth mentioned, I've been working with batterers for actually about 20 years now, and also some work with victims and children exposed to violence. I've been doing visitation work. Actually, the last supervised visitation center I ran, I left a few years before Safe Havens began, so it's been a little while since I've been actively doing the work. But let me tell you a little bit about what my goals are for the discussion today. There's going to be sort of three parts to it. I want to start with an introduction, just sort of overview of how I view the whole issue around battering and men using violence and what that means to me. The second part will be to talk a bit about the kinds of issues and problems that we often see at visitation centers. And then the third, we'll be doing some case scenarios and sort of trying to put the rubber to the road and see how this stuff applies. As Beth mentioned, I do want to invite people to chime in and feel like you can interrupt at any time. I'm perfectly comfortable with that. Specifically, though, when we get to the case scenarios, I'm going to be what I'll be is reading the scenario to the people who did not receive that through an email, and then asking us to address a few questions about the scenario so we can see how this stuff fits into the work that we do at our own centers. So, and then at the end, I'm hoping there'll be a few minutes where we can sort of recap, or if there are other, if this raises questions about, you say, well, yeah, that case scenario reminded me of something that goes on at my center, and you want to throw out a question for all of us to consider, that would be wonderful as well. So let's get started. In way of introduction, if we're going to be talking about problematic behavior that involves men who use violence, we're talking about how this relates to our work at visitation centers, it's probably helpful to start with an understanding of that behavior. So what is it that the batterer intends? What's the impact of that behavior on the victim, but not just on the victim and the kids, but also the impact of that behavior on visitation center staff? And so I wanted to touch on a few points or a few observations that I've heard people at visitation centers make, things that I've noticed and other people have noticed from having conversations with both men who have been violent with their partners as well as from those partners themselves. And the first distinction that I think is probably essential to this discussion, and many of you have heard about this before, is distinguishing between battering and resistive violence. And what we mean by that is that not all violence is abusive, and to flip that around, not all abuse involves physical violence. In other words, batterers use many tactics to control their partners, while victims who may also use violence do so as a way of resisting the abuse. So batterers use violence to control, and a way to think about it is that victims use violence to get out from underneath that control, or it's in reaction to the controlling tactics of the batterer. There's, I don't know if you've heard about this before, but many communities offer what are called primary aggressor trainings, or the more recent term, I guess, is predominant aggressor trainings. And this is often offered to our first-line responders, very often law enforcement, and other providers like judges, sometimes visitation providers, batterers intervention providers. And the purpose of a primary aggressor training or predominant aggressor training is to figure out who poses the greater threat, who is causing the greater harm, and on the flip side, who needs our service the most. Because if we merely ask ourselves who's being violent, it may be that the only person who has evidence of having been violent was the victim, and we end up arresting the victim and do nothing to interrupt the batterer's abusive control. And this is a really important distinction for visitation center staff to consider, as we consider the context of the violence and other tactics that they may use even while they're at the visitation center. One of the ways that it's been helpful for me in trying to sort this out, you know, is this battering, is this resistive violence, is this something else, is I ask myself a different question. Instead of who's violent, what I ask myself is who's jeopardizing the safety and autonomy of the other person. And by safety, I don't just mean physical safety, but psychological safety, emotional safety. And by autonomy, I really mean is someone interfering with the other person's ability to make decisions? Have they taken away their authority in the relationship? So, for instance, an abuser might undermine the authority of the victim by overriding her decisions around child rearing, for instance. So let me consider a couple of examples just to illustrate this. Imagine there's a child who is really frustrated because his father told him that he couldn't go outside and play or couldn't do something he wanted to do. And so the child, in frustration, balls up his fist and hits his father 10 times before the father even reacts. In response, the father, through his irritation, shoves the child down onto the ground and says, "If you ever do that again, you're going to be very, very sorry." The child is now terrified of the father. But if you ask yourself the question, who is more violent, you could actually make the argument that the child is more violent, because the child assaulted the father 10 times, and the father could say in response, "Well, yes, I pushed the child, but it was only in self-defense." The conclusion that would obviously be an error would be for us to say, well, since the child started it, since the child was the primary aggressor, and the child was the one who hit the father, and the father only acted in self-defense, that the child, therefore, is a domestic abuser and should be sent to a batterer's intervention program, incarcerated, fined, and the father should be offered shelter services, hotline support, and issued a restraining order against the child. That would be ridiculous. So this would be a case where it's pretty clear that just because we can document that one person's being violent doesn't necessarily mean that that's the person who's being abusive. The child was violent. The father, in response, was very abusive. Another example might be a victim who slaps her abuser. He's coming at her, cornering her in a room, and she slaps him as a way of trying to escape and to back him off. But if we ask ourselves, is she jeopardizing his safety or autonomy, the clear answer would be no, while the abuser, who has yet to even touch the victim, might well be jeopardizing her safety and autonomy by engaging in an ongoing pattern of battering behavior. So I just wanted us to sort of keep those distinctions in mind, because very often when we're at a visitation center, we don't have the opportunity to see the video of what happened in the home. We don't get to see, we may see reports, we do interviews, and we get their presentation when they come through the door, but we don't get to see the context of their behavior other than what they present when they arrive at our center. Some other characteristics.
Can I interrupt you for just 1 second?
Please.
I got a couple of emails saying that some folks are having a hard time hearing you.
Okay.
And so just to let you know, our operator has gained the maximum capacity to your line as possible, so just to let everyone know that we did that. So a couple of things to try. First is if you push star 4 on the participant's line, if you're having a hard time hearing, that increases the volume on your end, so that might help as well. Sometimes hanging up and calling back in also helps for those participants who are, if you're experiencing having a hard time hearing, that also might help, just having a different connection. So try those two things. And I don't know, Scott, if obviously you can't tell how loud you are, and you sound fine on my end. So, and the operator maximized and said the recording level is at max as well. So,
okay. What I'll do is I'll make sure that I am speaking right into the phone. Maybe I'll swallow half of it just to help.
Perfect.
So, because sometimes I can drift away from the phone, so that might be part of it as well.
Okay, thanks. All right,
sure.
Thanks everybody for letting me know. Carry on.
Okay. Just a couple other points or characteristics of men who use violence. One common misconception is that batterers do this because they have some kind of anger control issue. But I think a better way of looking at this is that batterers don't use violence because they are angry. They use anger as part of their violence. And actually, I didn't even come up with that phrasing. One of the men in my batterers intervention program told me that. He said, he didn't say this on his first session. This was many sessions into it. And he said, I don't lose control when I'm angry. I use my anger to control my partner. And so if I get angry enough or have that look on my face, then she's going to do what I want her to do. So the anger is what I use so that I don't have to use violence. Now, it doesn't mean that he won't use violence eventually, but the anger is something that's a tool rather than an explanation or a justification for the abuse. And we've noticed other people in all parts of the system, judges and prosecutors and defense attorneys and child protective workers, who really struggle to understand that. The risk, of course, in a visitation center is that if I expect him to be this angry, out-of-control, drunk person when he comes in the room, and he does not present that way, if he's calm, cool, and collected, I might unwittingly assume, well, he's obviously not the problem. He's not a risk. He seems like such a nice guy. And it's important to know that for many of them, this is a switch that they can turn on and off. Some of them do it consciously, and some of them maybe not so consciously. Another thing is that batterers adapt to the situation. If you think about a number of the issues that, say, child protective service workers deal with, like children who are hungry or children who don't have enough clothing, those problems are fairly stable, consistent, and predictable. A child's hungry, you give them food, hunger solved, at least temporarily. Batterers are different in that they will adapt to the situation. So if we intervene in a particular way, batterers learn about our interventions. They tell me about this when they come into my group. They talk about how they learn from the system, what the system is looking for, and they make adjustments. And the reason they make adjustment is that the issue is control. And if they get caught or detected, they lose control over their partner. The last one I'll mention is that batterers have a tendency to seek allies, but they stay wary of adversaries. And so he might be very cordial and cooperative when he first presents at a visitation center, and then only turns aggressive when he feels that staff is siding with the victim. And it's helpful for visitation center staff to see how this particular change in his presentation mirrors that of the experience of many victims. And what I mean by that is that when a potential batterer starts to get to know his eventual victim, he doesn't come across as this mean, angry, violent, controlling, abusive person, because if he did, there would be no second date, there would be no relationship. He would not have the opportunity to eventually be abusive or controlling in the relationship. I often ask the question, what's the difference between a batterer and a truly gentle man on a first date? And there are actually two answers to that. One answer is there's no difference at all. But the second answer is that batterers have a tendency to be a little bit nicer, which doesn't sound like it makes much sense, but they're a little bit nicer because they have to be, because it's strategic, because it's part of how they acquire their victims. It may sound a lot like I'm talking in the way that people talk about sex offenders when we talk about grooming behavior, and the fact is that batterers engage in a different kind, but sort of the same function. It's the same kind of grooming behavior where they gain access to people that they will be in a position to control. So, enough of the introductory stuff. What we're going to do is we're going to talk about several types of problematic behavior that gets presented at a visitation center. And there are four kinds that I want to highlight, though, and these will be addressed in the case scenarios that were emailed to you. But there certainly are other types, and if you'd like to throw your comments that you have as well out, or say, oh, we have something different going on at our visitation center, feel free to do that as well. And the four types I want to talk about, I'm calling constant contact is the first one, which probably another term for that would be stalking-like behavior, where someone is repeatedly having contact with staff at a visitation center. And I'll explain each of these in more detail in a moment. Hostility is the second one. So at what point does an abuser become aggressive, threatening, or violent, either outside the visitation center or at the center? Rule breaking, so which ones will try to push the envelope and see whether they can get you to change the rules, make an exception, see whether you take your rules seriously. And then the last one is ally seeking, the ones who will come in and be very cordial, polite, engaging, and are really looking to form a partnership with the staff, eventually in alliance against their partner or against other parts of the system. So in our discussion, the other thing I want to mention is that I will be keeping in mind, I'm going to make brief reference to it now, the guiding principles that I'm sure you are all familiar with at this point. There are six guiding principles that have been blessed by the Violence Against Women Office and went through a very lengthy multi-year process of development. And so I'm just going to mention those briefly here, and there will be some reference to them later as we go through the discussion. The first one is incorporating an understanding of domestic violence into our center services. And quite briefly, that's actually why we're having the phone call today, and why that there are so many training and technical assistance opportunities in the Safe Havens program, and why one of the requirements is for visitation centers to develop meaningful linkages with advocacy organizations and to sort of keep this as a primary focus of their work. The second principle is advocacy for children and adult victims. And by advocacy, we don't mean that you walk them over to the waiting room and hand them a brochure and out the door they go, but really some meaningful connections with outside agencies and doing some of the groundwork, doing some of the connecting to make sure that the services that are offered by the visitation center are working well in conjunction with the other supportive services that are available for her and her kids. The third principle is equal regard for the safety of children and adult victims. And for all too long of a period, I think many of us made the assumption that it was an either or. Either you focus on the safety of battered women or you focus on the welfare of the children. And I think eventually we realized that it was not either or, that actually protecting battered women is a child protective strategy, that the more that we can protect and empower her, the better position she is in taking care of the needs of her children. There was even some research that was done that looked at the outcomes for children who had been assaulted by their mothers. And what they found was that so many of those mothers had been abused by their male partners that when the women were safe and they were protected from those abusers and were offered meaningful services, the maltreatment that the women had delivered to the kids just dropped right through the floor, that a lot of this was abuse that was being passed through her to the kids. The fourth principle, valuing multiculturalism and diversity, the question for me and for many of us is, are our services accessible and respectful of differing cultures, backgrounds, realities? There's going to be a lot more detail that we're going to go into this in next week's call when you're going to have the opportunity to hear from Juan Carlos Arian. And in fact, that's going to be the focus of the conversation. So there won't be quite as much discussion of that in this week's call. The fifth principle is respectful and fair interaction. I can't tell you how many men in my domestic violence program have come in and said something along the lines of, well, it just isn't fair that she gets a restraining order and I don't. It's almost like a, you know, handing out food stamps or something. They think this is something that everyone should be entitled to. And it's true that it's not equal in that we don't give the same number of restraining orders to both members of the couple, but while it's not equal, it is fair. And to say that it's not fair is like saying that it's not fair that millionaires are not offered food stamps and able-bodied people are not offered motorized wheelchairs. Well, I don't hear any of them complaining. In fact, I don't think the millionaires or the able-bodied people would even want those services. They don't get them because they don't need them. Batterers don't get restraining orders. Actually, some of them do. But they're not supposed to get restraining orders because they, too, do not need them. And again, we come back to the question. It isn't who was violent. The question is someone's safety and autonomy threatened? This also relates to the concept of neutrality, and I know this has been a hot topic and a big issue for a long time. And just to be clear, we are not neutral about violence. We have a very clear stance against violence. In fact, if anything, we are biased towards safety. I mean, that's a value that I believe we all share. But as we set boundaries with people who use violence, we can do so in fair and respectful ways. We are not against men who are violent per se. We're against those men's use of violence, abuse, and control, if you understand the distinction I'm making. The last principle is community collaboration. Lots of ways of talking about this, but I'm sure you've heard of the short phrase 2220, referring to 2 hours approximately that families spend at the visitation center each week, 2 years, which is about the time frame when people are sort of working through custody, divorce, visitation, using our center, and then the 20 years, sort of the long haul, how long do you have responsibility for raising your kids. And in some ways, the 2220 is misleading, at least the first two, because when we talk about someone coming to the visitation center for 2 hours per week, I think we all know that while they may actually be in the building for 2 hours a week, the amount of time and energy and resources that we devote to taking care or arranging for and responding to that visit may far exceed those 2 hours. And one of the reasons for that is that visitation centers really are a unique service in that, unlike, say, batterers intervention or probation or even victim advocacy, we work with every single member of the family on an ongoing basis. So we are working with the batterers, the victims, the children, and over and over and over again. And because of that depth and breadth of work that we do, that intensive work, there's a real need for us to connect with virtually all other service providers who are addressing similar issues. So the need for us to collaborate and coordinate our services with multiple service providers is absolutely essential. So that's the my quick read of the guiding principles. I do want to sort of pause for a moment just to check in to see if there are any questions, comments, concerns that are hanging out there before we get on to sort of talking in more detail about what each of those problematic behaviors are that we're going to address for the rest of the call.
So we don't have anyone in the question queue right now, but if you do have a question or comment, please push one and we'll pop in there. And I haven't received any questions in my email box either. So, but I'll let you know, Scott, if any pop in.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Okay. Onward. So we're going to, like I said, use some case scenarios to brainstorm some suggestions for intervention. And to organize our discussion, there are going to be three questions that I'll be asking in connection to each of those scenarios. And let me just give you those up front so you can let them marinate a little bit. And I also suggest these as in having discussions with people who do visitation work. People said, well, how do I think through some of these tough cases? How do I think through some of the problematic behaviors? And they told me that, well, if there was a way for me to sort of organize my thoughts and go through a checklist of things that I need to consider, it's going to be a lot easier for me to generate some meaningful responses. So the questions that we came up with, first one was merely identifying the issue. So if something is bothering us, something is catching our attention, helpful if I can identify specifically what are the concerns that we have about the safety and autonomy of the adult victim and the safety of her children. What specifically do I think are the risks in that particular case? Second question is about consultation or collaboration. Is there anyone either at my visitation center, some other staff person, or my supervisor, or security, or someone in the larger community collaborative that I'd like to consult with, or I'd like to have a meeting with, or that I need to call immediately to help me handle a particular situation? And the third question is developing the intervention, so intervening. What would be a fair and respectful way for me to intervene that will help to ensure safety of the adult victim and the children, and will, you may have heard the phrase before, reduce the opportunity and inclination to abuse. So three questions again: identifying the issue, deciding who I need to work with to resolve this, the issue or the problem, and then what specifically can I do that will ensure safety. And you'll notice that the guiding principles will sort of pop up throughout this discussion. So let's get on to the four types of problems that we're going to talk about for the rest of today. The first one I mentioned was constant contact. And again, if you have access to your computer and do have the email, you'll see the scenario written out there. Before I read the scenario, I just want to talk a little bit about what I see as the intention of the person who's doing this and what their behavior might look like. So the person who's engaged in constant contact is likely attempting to use his resources, and these could be a pretty wide variety of resources: financial resources, legal resources, his time. Sometimes we refer to this as legal abuse. I worked with a man who was at a visitation center, and he had filed 63 motions with the court. Had gotten numerous guardians to excuse themselves from the case. Two judges recused themselves. Four attorneys quit. He ground down the entire system and just kept filing motion after motion after motion. And it had made this pretty much a career of his to see if he could last longer than anyone else. One of the purposes might be to keep tabs on what his partner is doing or what other service providers are doing. For many of them, it helps them feel in control of their lives by controlling others. This is the kind of person who may come across as very jealous, possessive, and obsessive, and very likely might be someone who would indeed be labeled a stalker and may even have stalking charges. Their behavior, as I mentioned, someone may be filing constant motions with the court. He may have frequent contact with the visitation center. He might be calling you two or three times a week to reschedule visitations or reschedule his intake or his orientation. He may ask a dozen different questions, some of which he's asked two or three times already. He may make special requests. They often have a restraining order or perhaps several restraining orders due to the stalking of the victim, and may appear that this has become his life's mission. I know of a couple of men in particular, in fact, one I'm thinking of right now, who actually did make this career, made the pursuit of his partner his career. He changed his job. He went and got training as a guardian ad litem, eventually opened up his own counseling service for parents who lost custody of their kids, and it just his entire life was wrapped up in this. And so some of them can have enough resources to really grind you down. So let's go on to the first case study, and I'd be curious if what I've mentioned so far and this particular case study rings any bells for you in terms of, yes, we've had people come like that through our center, and this is how we dealt with it. So here it is. Mr. Alvarez was recently referred to your visitation center. It took a month to arrange for his orientation as he needed to reschedule several times. Now that he is using the center weekly, your staff has complained that they are receiving lengthy phone calls from him several times each week, making it difficult to keep up with their other work. In addition, during visits, he is, quote, constantly asking about our policies, wanting us to send reports to his attorney and the courts. The requests never seem to end, end quote. You also have heard reports from the victim that she recently began receiving multiple hang-up calls in the middle of the night from an untraceable cell phone. So that's the case scenario. Again, are there any risks that you see? Who would you want to talk to, and how would you approach this? Is this something that you've had to deal with in your visitation center? And what kind of steps would you want to take to try and sort of rein this person in a little bit and make it a bit more manageable, as well as managing any risks that you see? And I will stop talking for a moment.
All right. So to chime in and talk with us, push number one, and Stephanie will help you get into the question queue. I also just sent out to everyone the questions that Scott identified so that you can also have those in writing and have them in front of you while we're talking about each of these cases. So look for them in your email box, your inbox momentarily. They should show up if they haven't already. And hopefully that will also help you kind of think through each of these case studies. And Scott, I also know that sometimes, you know, takes a minute for people to kind of mull over. I also know that lots of people are listening not by themselves but with a group of people on speakerphone.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm also hearing that they appreciate being able to kind of process in the room for a minute. And
yep.
So that's also on all of your ends, we recognize. So with that, we'll carry on and we'll let you kind of keep thinking through. As we move forward, it'll get easier, I promise. All right.
Let me just wait about another half minute, just give you a sense for that, and then we can move on or have a little discussion about this as people are pulling their thoughts together.
I got a couple people saying they didn't get it, so I'm just resending it. So be patient if it didn't come.
Most of the centers that I've talked to have talked about occasionally having that one person or the few people who just seem to drain an inordinate amount of resources from center staff. And it's not necessarily that the questions or the comments or the phone calls they receive are inappropriate, or it's not that they're being they're being rude, impolite, or hostile. Everything is, at least on sort of the face surface, is perfectly fine. But what really really stands out for them is what a large portion of their lives they spend ruminating over the operation of the center. And one of the things that some of them said was really helpful for them is they say each time that we experience something at the center, If we get frustrated because it feels like this person's wearing us down, or we get frustrated because it's hard to sort of move on to something else, or it's this constant repetitive nature, one of the things they do is they will step back and say, I wonder in what ways this is what the victim goes through. I wonder in what ways that there's some kind of parallel process where this person is really showing us what it's like to be with them, what it's like to be in a relationship with this person. And so one of the approaches that a visitation center talked about said, when I feel that and I don't really know what to do, sometimes I will make some process comments with the person who's doing this. And set my poem aside and say, you know, your questions are perfectly appropriate. I'm really glad to answer this. I'm glad that you're taking taking our policies seriously. And I also want to offer you a little feedback. I wonder if there are other, I sometimes feel that we sort of cover the same material over and over again, and I'm sort of glad to do that. I wonder if other people experience you the way I do. And they sometimes have these side conversations after a visit or so, if for no other reason to give the person some feedback and say, do you understand that sometimes you come across this way? Or they may have conversations with the victim and say, this is how it's coming across to us. Is this similar to what's going on in your family? One of the things,
well,
though,
we
that
we have a question.
Okay.
If we want to take that, Stephanie, would you help us?
Okay, we do have a question from Dorothea. Your line is open.
Dorothea,
hi.
Thanks for joining us.
All right, thank you. You had asked, just to answer some of your questions, part of what we do at our center is to funnel those questions through one person.
Okay.
We have a small center, and we would sit him down and say, talk to him about needing to go over the policies again and try to clarify, because our supervisors do not get involved in those questions,
mm-hmm.
and they would constantly refer back to the coordinator of the program.
Okay.
That he would need to only talk to that one person about policies and problems, and if he continued to talk about those while he was actually with his children, at some point the visit would be shut down, because that's part of the policy that, because they can't answer those questions, not appropriate to bring those up in front of the children, depending upon their ages and what the questions are exactly. So you're
really clear with them about, if you have questions, here's the appropriate channel, rather than just sort of ask anyone and go through the entire
Right. It's very clear. It's all written down, and if there continue to be problems, then we take it from the point of view that, well, first, we're going to make sure that you really understood everything, because most people have a tendency to forget after the first week a lot of times, because it's stressful coming in for the orientation. But then we would also look at bringing in the community in terms of if they had probation and parole, the guardian ad litem, that sort of thing, to just say that, not to say that, they're causing serious problems, but this is an issue that's been coming up over and over again, just so that they're aware that what's going on, besides talking to the partner, obviously, or the ex-partner.
Right. And is there anything, sort of the last part, where the reports from the victim that she's getting a bunch of hang-up calls, is there anything that you would feel a need to do with that, or is that...
Well, we're part of a domestic abuse agency already, and I would certainly make sure that, number one, they were talking to an advocate, and that we had a release to talk to their advocate about, if they wanted us to report it for them. It might depend. We generally would not pass that information on to the guardian ad litem. We would, that would be up to the advocate to do that part of it, because we do have a very good legal advocate here. But I would definitely pass them on to the our advocates here.
So you do have that sort of in-house connection, so there can be some follow-up there. Because I think what a lot of centers sometimes, and maybe especially ones not connected with an advocacy agency directly, a lot of centers sometimes don't realize that if she brings a report in, that the center may be the only place that's hearing about that.
Right. Where does it go after that?
Right. If any, and sometimes they say, well, I'm sure she's called the police, or I'm sure she's talked to an advocate, or I'm sure she's done something else. And very often that's not the case.
Right. And if it's a supervisor who hears it, generally they will contact the coordinator, me, someone, and we will make sure that they hear our take on it, and it goes, this is something you need to tell your advocate. Do you want us to pass it on and have them call you? Where do you want us to go with this? So the supervisor isn't actually handling it, but it gets passed through the loop, so it's taken care of.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dorothea. We have one other question in the question queue, but Dorothea, before you disconnect, I'm just wondering, thank you for sharing the way in which you have structured your program. Have you found that people do get frustrated if they can't ask a question? Because sometimes stuff just comes up, and sometimes it's just a really valid question they have.
If it's something related to, like, something they may have just misunderstood about whether they can go outside or not, that might be a question they would answer right there. But if they absolutely need to, the staff does have a way of contacting me 24/7.
Poor you.
I hardly ever do it. It's most of the time when the supervised person is told that, because I work 40 hours, you know, I'm full time, that they can contact me the next day. They would be happy to pass that on. All they have to do is call me. They never call me. So they don't. 99% of the time, I do not get calls about that question. I will step in and see the visit and see how things are going periodically. Mm-hmm. But generally, they really don't want to ask that question. It's just asked to. And I also run the batterers treatment program here, so I'm kind of got a unique perspective on it.
You're a busy person.
Yes, I am. It's kind of fun, though.
And we'll have Stephanie chime in this other question, and then we can move on. Stephanie, can you help us again?
Yes. Our next question does come from Tracy. Looks like she's left the queue.
All right. Well, Tracy, if you got disconnected accidentally, push number one, and we'll get you back in. And
okay, there she is. Tracy, your line is now open.
We actually left the queue because we thought maybe that things had been addressed. But we were just really talking about working with the survivor, you know, because this is clearly a sign of him escalating. And so just really, we would kind of be documenting our staff concerns the way that we would document, which I'm not going to go into here. But anyway, it would be that we have some concerns about her safety. And as far as answering his questions, we wouldn't answer him during the visit, but we would spend time with him afterwards or before the next visit, really going over what the policies he has in mind are, and we would give him the reasons why that's a policy. So that's all.
Would this, Tracy, would this ever generate any kind of outreach or informal conversation with other service providers, that sort of the risky piece at the end where it looks like he's escalating? I guess my question is, I know sometimes centers will do what we refer to as little mini case conferences.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll say, oh, this guy's in a batterers program and he's at the visitation center and he's being monitored by Child Protective Services. Why don't we get a meeting together and just sort of chat and see if other people are noticing the same kind of risky behavior?
Right. We wouldn't talk specifically. We don't talk to third parties, but we would be documenting our concerns in their family case file and that they both have access to.
Okay.
And there are times when we would tell a survivor that she should probably request her family case file.
Mm-hmm.
We would also be really encouraging her to work with an advocate. And if we are talking to her about what's going on and she knows he's in a batterers intervention program, we would be encouraging her to request her file so she could forward it on.
Yep.
So we would work around it as much as we could, but we specifically don't talk to third parties. So,
okay.
That's why it's so important that we document our staff concerns.
Hey, Tracy, before you hang up, I just received an email comment as well, and I know that you do this very well. And so just while we're having on the phone, somebody just emailed me and said a part of what they made a comment about is that they also discuss all of these situations with all the staff.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if you wanted to just talk briefly about your experiences and how important you've found that to be.
Yeah, it's essential. So we have weekly staff meetings, and that's all we do is talk about concerns with various cases that are happening. And so every case that we serve, every family we serve gets talked about by the full staff at least once every 3 or 4 weeks. So everybody knows what's going on. If we had somebody that was really, doing this with the staff, a lot of staff splitting, tying up people for their time, we would kind of develop a way we were going to respond. We would talk about it together, what's the best way to respond so that we're all on the same page with that. And we're pretty clear, you know, some of you have heard me say this, we have a rule, you can't say it's because it's the rule or because it's a policy. We really have to be able to explain why something is the way it is. And so we would just sit and talk, and we might decide who's best fit for that particular person to do the talk, who they have a best relationship with here. But it would be a staff discussion for sure. And then that's where we can document the staff consensus about the concern. So it's not I'm concerned that he's doing this. It's that as a group, we think this behavior is concerning.
Yeah. And how did you get to that place where you say that, you know, giving the answer because I said so, it just isn't a good response? How did that evolve?
I think maybe we tried it one time and it didn't fly.
Doesn't work with my kids either.
Right. We just have a philosophy here of that we're not, our goal is not to be punitive, and that just is a real punitive response. And so we feel like her safety is best preserved the more respectful we can be, and part of that is to be able to explain the rules. And then also just, I really have a strong personal belief that if you have a rule that you can't explain, then you probably shouldn't have that rule. So, yeah, it's all about being transparent and willing to kind of stand by what we say, but that means you have to not have a ton of rules. So.
Yep. Thank you for sharing that.
Sure. Now can I go?
More than you bargained for. I promise not to do that to anyone else who calls in. Thanks, Tracy.
The phones will now become silent.
That's right. No one, everyone will be afraid of me. And I'm just going to read this last part of the email that I got, that somebody had shared some comments that they wanted to share on the call. And there's the last statement that they made is, she indicates that being fair to the situation and realizing that every situation is unique is why we try to she goes on to refer to something else. But basically that statement about not treating everything in front of you as the exact same thing and giving opportunity to think through how can we best handle this, what are the safety concerns, all of those pieces, I think was a very nice way to pose that. So thank you for sharing that with us.
Absolutely. Yeah, it does go back to the being fair is not the same as being equal or identical. So good point. Okay, let's go ahead then to the second type of problem, and this one is about hostility. So many men who use violence use intimidation, anger, and violence to gain compliance from others, either from their partner, their children, or from professionals. This is not always apparent on the first contact, so they very often are not going to do this during the initial phone call, intake, orientation, maybe not even during the first few visits, but there may be a point at which they feel betrayed by their partner or by professional staff. And a common reaction, this is a common reaction to his feeling that his privilege and entitlement are being challenged. And so the way you may see this, it may be overt violence or threats of violence towards the partner. You may hear about this, may not be as likely to see it at the center. The violence or threats of violence towards the partner or the children, and in extreme cases, you might see it towards staff, though fortunately that's rather unusual, and I think that there's a lot of that credit goes to the ways in which we design our centers and the thoughtfulness and security measures and all the other stuff that we do. And the reason I mention that a lot of this credit goes to the visitation centers is that when we do risk assessments to try and determine how risky an abuser is, one factor that's often that's left off of the risk assessment schedule is the community itself. So we say, well, you know, how likely is it that this person's going to violate a restraining order? That in large part has to do with how effectively we reinforce restraining orders. So one person in one community might be far less risky than in another community. So we indeed can be risk factors or risk managers. And I think the whole visitation field, and especially safe havens, has done a really great job of getting us to think through to the point where we become really good risk managers. So this person might be there might be physical aggression or verbal aggression, including body language, gestures, tone and volume of voice, facial expression, sarcasm. All of these might be parts of the hostility. He might refuse to obey rules of the center or threaten to report to the court his dissatisfaction with your services or policies. The other thing about, I guess I want to say about the risk assessment too, is that it's important to note not just whether or not someone is coming across as having a hostile attitude or behavior, but really noting what has changed recently. And this is a relatively new piece of risk assessment out in the risk assessment community. We used to think that it was, you know, a little bit of violence is bad, and then you look to see if it gets to be more. Or if someone drinks a little bit, that's risky, but if he drinks more, it's more risky. And everything was this sort of single direction. And what we've starting to realize is that what's more important than does someone own a gun or does someone drink, what's more important is what's changed recently about that behavior. So if you notice that someone has a sort of constant level of being irritating at the center, that may not be a high risk. But if you notice someone who's normally really calm and very polite and then comes in and all of a sudden starts to have a change in attitude, all of a sudden seems to present differently, that may indeed be far riskier than someone who's always much more irritating than that person is. So let's get on to the case scenario. And see if this reminds you of anyone that you may have seen at your center. So here it is. The visitation supervisor intervened with Mr. Wilkins when she saw him slap his child's hand after his child refused to put down a toy that his father told him to put down. Your center has a no-hit, no-spank policy. Once the supervisor intervened with him, Mr. Wilkins stood up and said, "So I suppose you think that because you're the one with the clipboard, you can tell me how to raise my children. Well, my kids know I would never hurt them. Now, if someone else caused problems with my kids, well, that would be a different story. Understand?" So what does this raise for you? Do you see any particular risks? Who would you want to chat to? And what do you think would be a fair, respectful, and effective way of intervening in that situation? Let me give you a few seconds to mull that over.
Okay, so as you talk in your offices together, those of you who are listening together, or those of you who are by yourself, if you want to push number one and just give us your thoughts, your initial responses, there's no one right answer. I just wanted to make that clear. All the case scenarios that we presented last week and the case scenarios we'll continue to present, there's just not one way to look at it. And one way to respond, that we all learn from each other. We all learn from our mistakes, and we grow from them. And so if you have some initial thoughts about ways to look at it or things you would suggest, we can all benefit from hearing you. So please feel free to do that. You can also email me, and I will do my best to paraphrase your question, too.
The other thing I'll mention, too, about the case scenario as you're thinking about it is that when we ask about, you know, is there – a particular risk. This isn't just, of course, risk to the child or to the adult victim, but, you know, are there any risks to staff members or other people involved in the situation?
Scott, we have a question or a comment.
Okay. Gina, your line is now open.
Hi, Gina.
Hi, Gina.
Gosh, we scared them again.
Okay.
Probably, I promise, but I probably won't continue to keep you on the line if you talk to us. Push one, because we got disconnected.
I'm hearing an echo in ours that, oh, no, I'm not hearing it anymore.
Okay, we do have a question from Stephanie. Your line is open.
Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, Beth. Hi. I was just, I don't know, I guess in this situation, I sort of feel like there's that the visit should be, well, not necessarily ended, but that there needs to be some sort of discussion and not in front of the kids. I mean, you know, I think him saying something like, you know, do you understand, like sort of like, you know, you're causing a problem with me and my kids and you don't want to do that, but that's
mm-hmm.
sort of behavior that the kids have seen him use with other people, and they need to know that that's not going to happen in the center. So it seems like it needs to be handled directly, but in a way that's not going to frighten the kids. You see what I'm saying? But I don't know if it would make sense to actually say, okay, we need to step out for a minute and talk about this, or have somebody come in and be with the kids and address it with him. But it seems like because of that last little part that he says, that it needs to be addressed immediately and not glossed over, and just let the visit continue, you know, after he says that. But, you know, so mm-hmm. I don't know. I guess I'm curious as to how somebody would address that, because it seems very important to make sure that the kids know and he knows that he can't use those same behaviors in the center.
Yep. Okay.
Stephanie, I think you pose a really valid question. I think it's an all too frequent occurrence at a visitation center where we just get in this pattern of intervening and having the parent pulled away from the child.
Right.
And so the question that you pose, I think, is something that we do need to consider in this case scenario and many other case scenarios that we encounter in our visitation centers, is how can we support children in our center as well? And many times it's helpful to have those interventions happen with children. Not always, but there is some value to children understanding that you're upholding their safety as well as their mother's safety while they're at the visitation center. And so I think your comment is very insightful, so thanks, and hopefully we can kind of mull that over along with other folks' comments and questions.
Okay, thanks.
So, Scott, I don't think we have anybody else who's jumped
okay.
in.
Sure. Well, one of the things that I think about with that is do our clients, when they come in, say, would this man at our centers, would he know what our policy is ahead of time with regard to the perception, our perception, that he's acting in a hostile way? Maybe he thinks he's being hostile. Maybe he thinks he's just standing up for his rights. Maybe he thinks he's just protecting his child. He may or may not know how he's coming across. And I think, as you're pointing out, Beth, too, sometimes it's helpful for the children to know that we're there to protect them. And so one of the things I wonder about is, you know, do we have something in our policies and procedures so when they come in for orientation, that they read something that says, you know, in the event that a staff member believes or feels threatened, feels that you're being hostile, however that wording would be, these are the steps we would take. You know, we would, you know, give you a code word, we want to move you from the room. We would start the conversation in an appropriate way in front of the child and then ask you to leave the room where we can finish up the conversation or something else. But do we have something set out so that they know what the expectation is? And I was having this conversation with one center. In fact, this is where this particular scenario came from. And we're having a conversation about alerting people ahead of time. And one of the policies that they had was that they said, well, what we want to do is we want to the person I was talking to defined herself as a victim advocate. And she said, well, based on my background, I have done hundreds of safety plans with victims. But what I haven't done is develop responsibility plans with perpetrators. What I haven't done is to say, in the event that you are posing a risk, what steps do we need to take? What would happen? How are people going to respond around you? She said, in the context of visitation centers, that this was a perfect opportunity. So what they were looking at was, well, why don't we do this during an orientation session and be really work out a responsibility plan with that parent, and not just are saying, here's what we're going to do to you, or here's how we're going to respond to you, here's when we're going to take your kids away, here's when we're going to suspend you, here's when we're going to do whatever. But we're going to ask them initially, how do you think we should respond if we feel threatened, if we feel you're being hostile, if we detect a problem? What do you think would be a reasonable response? And when she said that, she said, well, you know, her initial expectation was that they would just say, well, I don't think you should do anything, you just misunderstand, you know, get a grip and leave me alone. What she noticed when she asked a few people was that the responses that they gave sometimes were much stricter than the ones that they would have come up with themselves. I hear this from parents a lot. They say, well, I asked my child, you know, what do you think should be the punishment for, or the discipline or response to your breaking a dish or, you know, torturing your sister or whatever the issue is. And they said it's amazing how much kids sometimes will suggest corrective actions that are more severe than what the parent would have suggested in the first place. She says, well, so why not try this in this setting? And she said, that's what we noticed, is that people were coming up with some really meaningful and appropriate kinds of suggestions, like, yes, I think you should invite me to leave the room, or yes, we should talk about this, or yes, there should be some discussion maybe also with the child about a particular component of it. And she said the other advantage that they noticed was that if they had a conversation early on, right at the orientation, right up front, about appropriate ways for the center to respond to inappropriate behavior by a parent, that the parent then had some buy-in, that they had already signed on to this safety or responsibility plan, and in fact may have had some input into its creation. Now, the other cautionary note you threw out was, well, sometimes they come up with really lousy suggestions, and of course we can't put that in the policy, and it needs to be consistent with how we run the center. But looking for people taking responsibility for their violence and their other forms of abuse should happen at every level, every juncture, in every setting. And so why not have them do some of that work while they're here, rather than us being the ones to, you know, decide whether they cross the line and then what all the corrective action should be. So I thought that was a very sort of interesting perspective on how do we engage people in taking responsibility for their behavior. Because we certainly at visitation centers, you know, spent a ton of time coming up with policies and procedures and responses, and I thought it was very creative to find ways to involve the parents as well. Let me just pause for a moment to see if there are any other questions or comments before we move on.
I also want to do a time check with you, Scott. We have just a few minutes, 7 minutes left, it looks like.
Okay.
And I don't have any questions, it looks like, in the queue. I have one comment from the last case scenario that I'll just quickly read and leave folks with. So I'm going to try and paraphrase quickly, and it's not my strong suit. a very rich comment here. So the comment is, this is a definite risk, and I would hope we would have noticed his demeanor beforehand. And understanding behavior and reacting to having something precious taken away from him. At first, as a staff member sitting there, I'd want to reassure him that I'm not there to judge his parenting skills. However, no one, whoever it may be, will do any type of abuse while at the center, desensitizing him by allowing him to see his father, but he can't not use that behavior in front of the in the center. Bottom line, the child loses out on quitting the visit. But it does need to be addressed, is what this comment was.
Okay. Thank you. I think we may have time to do one more of these. Do one more briefly. What do you think?
All right. You're brave.
Okay, I'm brave. Let me just touch on the rule-breaking one. The last one, ally-seeking, we've actually sort of covered that in pieces of the other ones. So let me just briefly touch on the rule-breaking. The intent here, batters often want to see how seriously we take his behavior. A lot of times they're trying to see, do we really take this seriously? Do we think that violence against women is all that bad? Society hasn't quite embraced that yet. So they may show up late for scheduled appointments, want to leave early, ask you to make an exception, sort of just this one time, really wanting to be viewed as, well, I'm not like those other guys who really beat their wives, so I'm different. The rules really shouldn't have to apply to me. So let me just throw out the case study to think about, and maybe you can have more of a discussion when you get back to your centers. Mr. Bird's been using the visitation center and attending a batterer's program for several months. Now, frequently he shows up late, but he's always sort of within that 15-minute window that's allowed. Occasionally shows up without the required payment, but he promises to send it in by mail. He forgets to send it in, but then brings it in with him in the next appointment. So, oh, I guess I'm just not that organized. Once he forgot which entrance was for the non-custodial parent and mistakenly, in quotes, went the wrong way. He's been arrested twice for violating a restraining order, but claims that it was not his fault. So I had no way of knowing that she would be at the grocery store, at the restaurant at those times. And at the end of the last visit, he received a call on a cell phone and said, I have to leave now before the end of my 15-minute waiting period. My babysitter canceled, so I have to go pick up my daughter now. I'm sure you understand. He then left just moments after his ex-wife had left. And so you may see a number of particularly sort of risky behaviors. It's really sort of pushing the envelope.
So, Scott?
Yeah.
You know, when I process case scenarios with sites who call in for some assistance or just kind of processing, I just want to put out there that as soon as kind of these kinds of case scenarios are put out there, not always, but many times I get people who kind of knee-jerk back and say, well, we don't have a policy, or we have a policy about cell phones, so that would curb that, or we don't have this 15-minute window, so that would curb that. Or, you know, it brings out kind of these rules that they would say seem to be broken, or if we created a rule, then this couldn't happen. And before you kind of go there to feel like you're shoring this up, that then this wouldn't happen here, is that you can create a 500-page document on all the stuff you can't do at a visitation center, and it would still never stop kind of the stuff that's happening behind this, right? You could create the cell phone, but the rule that you can't use a cell phone and get some phone calls, for example, but there would be something else in this situation that would then come out instead. So before you kind of jump to, we just shore this up and make this harder, kind of think through that a little bit about what it is. So I want to throw that out there.
Yeah, I think it's a really, really good observation and comment. And one of the things that, and this is sort of a, it doesn't address this particular case, but it was sort of a concluding comment or things that some communities have found helpful in designing their policies, because, right, it could end up being 500 pages long if you try to get every possible contingency. And one of the things that some centers have done is say, you know, since we can't really sort of predict all this stuff, one of the things that's helpful is to periodically conduct walkthroughs of your services. What I mean by that is having someone who, say, works, who's a really experienced person working in a batterer's intervention program, or a really experienced victim advocate, or someone from a disabilities rights community, walk through the services from start to finish, the original phone call, the intake, orientation, as if they were visiting with their kids. Have these people walk through your services and then sort of listen for feedback from them about, well, what would it be like if you were in this place? If you're a batterer's intervention person, what kinds of ways do you think someone could exploit this our center the way it's set up? What kind of risks do you think there are? If you're talking to the advocate, how would you feel safe if you're walking through the service? Or what kinds of things do we need to tighten up? If it's someone from a disabilities rights group, are there kind of barriers that make our service inaccessible? And so I guess the general recommendation is taking opportunities to involve many people around the community to really get inside and take a look at our centers and to sort of help us think through, either on a case-by-case basis or in just more general, how is our center working. It's sort of a fishbowl technique about, you know, saying, you know, I think Tracy was talking about transparency, but ends up being very, very helpful, not just to visitation centers, but to other providers as well.
Yep, I think that's great. I'll throw out just a couple of other kind of random strategies that sometimes are helpful too. This goes along the line of what Scott was just suggesting, but also taking case scenarios and case studies, not a particular case, but kind of a sampling of what's happening, or taking names out, and bring in community partners to discuss it so that you are using those folks who are facilitating batterers intervention in your community, and your domestic violence advocates and your court partners, and all of those folks should be helping you strategize on how to effectively work with men. So when you get up to those kind of, what do we do here, you have some go-to people that are right in your community. And it really helps those partners also understand what you're facing at the visitation center. And it helps, you know, enhance that relationship, so it has a lot of positive outcomes. The other kind of hands-on strategies that I found very helpful is being as intentional about planning for visits as possible and having lots of communication with everyone in the family, so that if you take time, for example, with men who come into your center, if they're the visiting parent, to talk about first, before the first visit even happens, what their expectations are, try to kind of lessen those anxiety, those fear situations that are coming up in their mind before that first visit even happens, and then in an ongoing way, what's happening, how can we make this situation better, how can we check in on a regular basis to make the least amount of fear and anxiety build for people and address things head on. Now, the more powerful your relationship is, the better you have to put kind of a container on safety, the things that come up. If you don't have a relationship with somebody and things are happening right in front of you, you have a much more difficult time intervening and addressing those things. So that's one thing that I'll pass on. And I'm noticing the time. I try to be very respectful of all of your time because I know that you've taken time out of your busy day, and now we're a minute and a half over. I apologize. But, Scott, do you have any last parting words and suggestions or strategies that you want to pass along before I do our parting goodbyes?
No, I think it just sort of in concert with what you just said, thinking that the whole intervention engagement process begins even before the first visit, and then that whole relationship building goes from point A all the way to point C, and so at each stage being that really sort of mindful intentionally setting up each visit and then processing it makes a lot of sense to me. So, I think that covers it well.
All right. So I want to thank Scott for taking time to prepare for the call and be on the call with us. I want to thank all of you for taking time out to be on the call with us. I recognize that 75 minutes for some of you flew by. It flew by for me. And we can't begin to crack this nut in 75 minutes. We recognize that, but it's one of those opportunities that is pretty easy to do, is to call into a number and sit back and think for a minute and have some new ideas posed. So hopefully, at the very least, there was some creeping up of new ideas that happened for you, or some additional questions that you want to dig further into, and that's great. That's what we hope to accomplish in these training series. I'm going to send out an evaluation shortly. It'll be an online survey, so it'll be a link that you click, and please fill that out. I try to incorporate as much as we can into each series and into each training session that we provide, so it's very helpful. And next week, I want to let you all know that it'll be the final of this three-part series on culture and our work with men. And as Scott had mentioned, Juan Carlos Arellan from the Family Violence Prevention Fund will be joining us for that call. I will be posting a PowerPoint and a link to several video clips that we're going to use. And because this is an audio call, we won't be able to show the video clips, so we're going to post them on our website in hopes that you'll be able to watch them before the call. They should be posted. It takes our web browser just a minute to refresh itself, so within 24 hours it should be able to be viewed. And for those of you who can't do that, it's absolutely fine. Stephanie is going to help us facilitate the audio portion of those video clips, and so we'll listen to those on the call. But if you wanted to actually see them, you can do that via our website. And I think that's it. So thank you again for joining us. I apologize for keeping you a few minutes after, but please join us next week. And thank you all. Have a great day.